From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this half hour will be made on Tuesday night in Rochester at the Hatch Hall at the Eastman School of Music at the U of R. Two familiar voices and names will be there, NPR's David Greene and Robert Smith. Of course, you know David Greene from Morning Edition, and Robert Smith is NPR's Planet Money correspondent. They are going to be right here in Rochester to try to help families move forward in their own financial journey. And as much as that can sound like drudgery, they have promised to make it fun. So we're thrilled that they are taking time to join us for this half hour. David, Robert, thank you for joining the program. It's nice to talk to you both.
It's great to be here, Evan.
It's wonderful to be here. Thanks.
All right. So how do you make money fun? Besides, Kai Rizdahl does that every night, I guess. But so you have a pretty good model there. But, you know, so many families feel that this is the part of their lives that is the hardest to sort of penetrate and structure. They often will say, oh, I'm just going to have somebody I know do the books, et cetera. Our guy is going to help us. We have an analyst, an advisor. And they kind of disengage. How do you make this fun?
I don't know, Robert, I'm going to let you jump in here, too, because maybe we don't have the exact same opinion. But I think the events that we've done, Robert and I, definitely not the experts. That is the one thing that becomes very clear from the beginning. What we bring together, you know, a panel of people who, you know, they themselves are really accessible and talk about, you know, financial decisions in a really kind of conversational way. But Robert and I feel like we sort of just play the role as of, you know, curious people, like people in the room. And I mean, it's our job just to engage and make it just a place where you can sort of feel safe. You can ask a lot of questions. You can talk about sort of what's on your mind, some personal decisions your family, you know, might be making. And, you know, a lot of these decisions that we talk about, there's no right or wrong answer, but just the mere fact that we're all there in a room together having a conversation, sort of understanding that a lot of things that we're going through are things that other people can relate to. You know, there's a lot of empathy in the room, a lot of meeting new people. It's just a neat way to talk about tough decisions that keeps it sort of lively and fun. And honestly, I mean that.
And there's no math involved. There's no numbers.
Which is really good.
I was told there'd be no math.
There is no math. Because I think one of the problems with business coverage is that it so focuses on numbers instead of people and stories. And behind every number is an actual story. And one of the great things about doing this event and talking to people is that when somebody asks, how do I pay for college? That's not a cry for practical advice. That's really a story about their dreams they have for their children and how they want to accomplish those dreams. And so we really talk about people's lives in these events and talk about what it is they want. How do you set priorities? And, you know, we have experts with us who can help people do that.
We have David Greene and Robert Smith from NPR with us for this half hour. They're going to be here Tuesday night at the University of Rochester's Hatch Hall at the Eastman School of Music. The event starts at 7. It's called NPR Presents Family Matters, Your Financial Lifetime, and it's in conjunction with WXXI. Seating is limited, we should say, so head to WXXI.org to reserve your seats today if you want to get out there Tuesday night to talk to David and Robert. And you're not alone, as you said. You've got a panel. Can you guys tell us about some of the other folks who might be able to help us on Tuesday?
Yeah, we actually, it's a great lineup, and we've actually worked with all three of these people before. Michelle Singletary is an author and a nationally syndicated columnist for The Washington Post. She is entertaining, and she gets real. I mean, she will talk about, you know, give answers to questions, and she sort of doesn't hold back at all. Louis
Barajas. I'm just going to warn you, if you are in debt, if you have any credit card debt whatsoever, Michelle Singletary will set you straight.
she will indeed. And then Luis Barajas, he's an author and a personal finance expert. And then our third member, Erin Currier, she directs the Pew Research she's at the Pew Research Center and studies economic mobility. And she really was wonderful at the event that we did with her because she was able to sort of delve a little bit into some numbers and research, but in a way that I could understand, which sort of means everyone can understand. So it's a great group, and they really, all three of them, keep it very casual. And I loved just that they were so engaged and interested in hearing people's stories. And they weren't there to sit on a stage and lecture, which was great. I mean, they were listening to what people in the audience had to say, what questions they had, and then really sort of grappling with the stuff that came up.
Can I ask about Michelle Singletary? I mean, if I were to admit to Michelle that this morning I stopped and got a, it was a cortado. It's like a cappuccino. Would she beat me with a wooden spoon for doing that, or would she talk some sense into me about the morning lattes that that seem to add up?
Does a cortado come with a spoon?
That's the It should.
It should. For the amount you paid for that cortado, I bet it came with a nice silver spoon in it. But no. I mean, she would have no problem with you using credit cards and that sort of thing. It's the ongoing revolving debt that she has a problem with. And to really think about what you're using debt for, I mean, debt is a tool, and people use it for building long-term things. People go into debt for college, which often happens, or for a house. But, you know, using it for a daily cortado and not paying that off, yeah, that's pretty irresponsible.
We're talking to David Green and Robert Smith from NPR, who will be here in Rochester Tuesday night, 7 o'clock, I should say. That's the 9th of September, 7 o'clock at the Hatch Hall at the Eastman School of Music at the University of Rochester for their NPR event, Family Matters, Your Financial Lifetime, and we're proud to partner with them right here at WXXI. Guys, I read, my father sent me in the mail a speech that he loved, and it was a speech by Kai Ryssdal, and in which Kai said, most people are surprised to find out he's bored by market talk. He's bored by money, that he loves stories and storytelling and illuminating the economy with great storytelling. And I actually found that inspiring to hear, because a lot of people would assume that he's a sort of a markets geek. And what it says to me is if you choose to be and you find sort of a hook that you like, you can become proficient at just about anything, even if you don't love it. And we would have to all do that with our own personal finances. You think there's a lesson there?
Oh, there's totally a lesson. And I don't want to make Robert blush here, but when I got to NPR, I mean, his style of storytelling was one that I tried to sort of model myself after, because Robert can know a subject, I mean, through and through, but then tell a story in a way that just draws you right in, and it's absolutely engaging. And I love sharing a stage with him in places like Rochester. But I do think that's a really great point. I mean, we're not there to sort of delve into markets and numbers. I mean, it's real lives. I mean, Robert and I were together at the New York Bureau of NPR some years ago, and I was brought on to the business desk, amazingly, because I didn't know anything about markets and numbers and the economy. And one of the projects I did was just to literally get out into the country for President Obama's first 100 days in office and just talk to people and literally spend time out there in communities listening. And, you know, it's that kind of storytelling that I think, you know, we just truly enjoy doing in our daily jobs. And that very sensibility is what we kind of bring to events like this.
Well, you are too kind.
Are you blushing,
David?
Robert? Are you blushing?
Are you blushing? I'm sorry, Robert.
I am actually blushing on the radio. But, you know, it's not just me. It's the whole team we have here at Planet Money, where, you know, this sort of, I don't want to say ignorance, but there is a certain simplicity that we're trying to get at with all these stories, which is, what are they really about? Like, they're really about people, and they're really about sort of fundamental questions out there. It does not matter what the Dow Jones Industrial Average is today or tomorrow, or the next day. And we'll just say that straight out. I don't know it, and I'm an economics correspondent. But, you know, the forces that move people and the forces that move markets and businesses, the sort of basic principles of economics, are some of the things that affect our lives. They're as important to, you know, to know as the sort of forces of politics out there. And for too long, business coverage has been so dull in a way, focusing on all these numbers, focusing on the markets. And Kai Ryssdal does a great job at this, as saying, like, it's okay. It's okay if you don't understand some of this stuff, because the basic principles are what's important, and the stories are what's important, and people's hopes and dreams and how they want to go about that. That's what economics is out. And that's why it's important, and that's why it's fun. I mean, that's what keeps it fun for me, is literally discovering things every day that I had no idea. You know, just recently it was a podcast on how the signature came about. So when you sign for your cortado, like, who's actually looking at that signature if you put on a credit card?
I have to go back and listen to that. That's great.
Turns out they do archive all of this, just in case you deny it, even if you said you drank it on the air.
David and Robert are going to be here Tuesday night, and hope you can join us at 7 p.m. at Hatch Hall at the Eastman School of Music. David, you mentioned paying for college. It's a common issue on this program. We have talked about the rising cost of higher education. We talked about the fact that between Syracuse and Buffalo, there are, I think, six colleges that are roughly $60,000 a year now. Now, again, not a lot. Most of the students don't pay quite the full ride, but even if you're only paying $44, you're only paying $44. And you guys on Morning Edition really covered this story. You sat down and you listened to those personal stories. And to Robert's point, you could look at all the technical data, the rising cost of college, the percentage increase versus inflation to 40 years ago to today. Or you could sit down with families and say, what is this doing to you? What is it doing? What is student loan debt doing? David, can you share some of what you found when you reported earlier this summer on student loan debt?
Yeah, I mean, there's no easy answer. I think that is one thing that really came across, and that's why it was so important to listen to people. You know, we would talk to someone, and they would say, you know, I have $100,000 of student debt. And if we ended the conversation there, it's like, what does that tell you? But then you dig in and you sort of understand, you know, why that debt is there. Okay, you know, I made a decision to go to a school that I don't feel like, you know, looking back, it was, you know, I got that much value out of it. And looking at my career path right now, you know, am I getting something out of all that debt? And, you know, it's questions like that. And you know, a lot of the people we spoke to were saying that we hope that sharing our stories can help the generation coming up now and thinking about college. And, you know, this is a really, really difficult time for this generation. Getting some sort of education after high school, you know, seems to be more important today than ever in the job market. But, you know, it's easy to hear that and then jump to, oh, I have to go get a four-year degree, and isn't that going to be really expensive? But depending on sort of what you're interested in, what your dreams are, you know, what your means are, I mean, all sorts of different choices might make more sense. You know, community colleges, different kinds of training. So exploring those questions, really important. But if you hear just numbers, $100,000 in debt, what does it mean? I think it was really nice, you know, to just hear stories about what people were going through. And we hope that our listeners were able to, you know, at times just say, wow, that's exactly what I'm going through, too. I can sort of share in this moment of real decision.
And like a lot of these issues in economics, it's about the sort of long-term vision versus the short-term cost. And we always pay attention to what things cost. But you know, one of the things we've tried to do at Planet Money is really explore the long-term benefits you're getting out of education, the monetary benefits, and putting numbers on that. You know, the hundreds of thousands of dollars that you will get over a lifetime because of that degree. And it's substantial any way you cut it. Even though the $100,000 in debt is rare and is serious, most people have much less debt than that. And, you know, you said already that the sticker cost of college is not exactly what people pay. But sitting down and really looking at what, for careers, there are places that'll do this online for you, what careers can pay you on average over your lifetime, and you'll find that it is just like any other form of investment. It's going to cost you up front, and it's going to pay out over your lifetime. So you have to make those kind of decisions.
But I think, Robert, another thing that Planet Money does so well is it helps, it elucidates certain points that we may not consider, or some of younger listeners to NPR may not consider. We've talked to 20-somethings who they think 6 to 8% interest is no big deal. That doesn't sound like a lot. And all of a sudden, 6 to 8% interest, they're amazed that the way it can pile up. And I just think that Planet Money does such a great job of taking, again, data points, numbers, et cetera, and fleshing it out in real ways. And I imagine you've met plenty of students, young graduates, who are shocked to know what kind of bills they're staring at.
The power of compound interest is the most powerful force in the universe, and for good and for evil. And so you spend a lot of time when you talk to young people, both showing them the good side of this. Like, there is a good side. If you sign up for your retirement plan at your first job when you are 21, you're going to be a very lucky 40, 50, 60-year-old because of that. But also, if you lock yourselves into contracts, high interest rates, you are going to be very sad about that. So I do wonder about this generation have grown up in sort of a low interest rate environment. You know, I think for a lot of very young people, like, they've seen a recession, maybe they've graduated during a recession, having difficult times. They're watching the economy grow, but nowhere near what maybe David and I saw the economy grow during maybe the 80s when we graduated. But it is, I'm really curious how this generation will react to money, just looking at the kind of interesting history they've had to live through.
We're talking to NPR Morning Edition host David Greene and NPR Planet Money correspondent Robert Smith. They're going to be in Rochester Tuesday night at 7 p.m. for an event at the Hatch Hall at the Eastman School of Music. It's called NPR Presents Family Matters, Your Financial Lifetime, and you can still reserve seats today. But I'm told seating is limited, and WXXI is glad to partner. So go to WXXI.org if you want to reserve your seats. Guys, about a couple weeks ago on this program, we had a financial panel all based on I read an article in The New Yorker by John Lanchester on the sort of the opaque language of economics and finance and the way that people give up and say, I think part of Lanchester's point was every industry has its jargon, has its slang, but finance can be more opaque than others. It can be difficult to penetrate, and that's why a lot of families say, well, I'll let somebody else handle the money or make these decisions. But he argues that if we give up on understanding it, then we not only make maybe poorer decisions in our own lives about our month-to-month spending and saving, et cetera, but we also give up on sort of understanding policy prescriptions at the national level that impact us because we're not in the conversation. And then we give the conversation to a small group of insiders, and they dominate it. Do you agree with that?
I think it – I mean, this is one thing we actually looked at when it comes to the opaque language that you're talking about in financial aid forms when you're thinking about going to college in the series that you mentioned, Evan. I mean, it's – there are – they can be really intimidating. And sometimes, you know, families, students will just sort of, you know, toss the pages out the window. You know, there are guidance counselors who are dealing with far too many students than they should have to deal with. And sometimes they're not there to offer advice. And there's a real push right now to just simplify and make these forms sort of get the information from families that they need to get without being so sort of crazy and intimidating and making people feel like they just, you know, have to give up. And I think that is really important. And I think it is one of the things that sort of is the foundation of these events that we're doing. I mean, it's sort of sending a message that these are really hard questions, and sometimes numbers and sort of the economic stuff can seem intimidating. It's not. We can just ask that this – no question is stupid. No question is too simple. Sort of ask whatever is on your mind, and we'll all talk about it.
And, you know, part of the problem is those of us who do this for a living as journalists. Like, the more we just talk about GDP and – ARs and how the Dow did today, the more we do that, the more people disengage because we don't actually explain it. People are like, oh, yeah, that's the unemployment rate, without really going into what does it mean? What is a GDP? You know, what does it represent? What am I supposed to think about this? You know, we fill time with these numbers and these acronyms as part of the financial press. And, you know, one of the things that we try to do at Planet Money and we try to do at these events is just like, None of the complicated talk. Just really say, like, what are we talking about? What does it mean? Just explain it to me. Because we found that there's a certain pleasure in actually understanding what's going on, even though it may seem simplistic to say, like, it is the gross domestic product and here's what it represents. People want to know these things.
You got a few more minutes left with David Greene and Robert Smith from NPR. Let's grab a call. This is Rich in Rochester. Rich, thanks for calling.
Hello. I have to say that Planet Money, I proselytize about that show more than any other show, and I've listened to every podcast.
Oh, thanks.
Had. The level of education you guys give on that show and simplifying these things from the lady who had the 800 credit rating on $11,000 a year to what gold means in our economy, I think is priceless, and it's unfortunate. It's hard to get people to listen to it, but I tell them it just
keep
it
trying.
Just touches so many parts of your life, and you should just feel it. That's all I have to say. I didn't have a question. I just had to really commend you guys on an amazing job of what you're doing.
Thanks, Rich. Thanks for the call.
So
and by the way, Robert, I don't think it's that hard to get people to listen to it. I mean, we talk to people who listen to it every day. I think Rich's point is it's the same point that both of you are making, which is that when you talk money and finance and economics, it can be hard to get people in general to want to plug into it.
I had a note. I had a note the other day where somebody said, "Oh, I've avoided listening to that podcast, Planet Money, because I thought it was just financial advice,
like
a financial call-in show." We didn't know. Really, it's not really about money. It's not really about economics. It's about people. It's about stories. And sometimes we think, oh, maybe we chose the wrong name for it. But, you know, this is part of our job is to say it doesn't have to be boring. I mean, think about the things that you love to talk about. If you find out, oh, somebody had to take out this huge loan or somebody got a huge raise with this amount of money. We love to talk about money. We love it. And yet somehow we've missed a lot of this in the financial press. We've made it too complicated. We've made it too much about numbers, too much about corporations, instead of what it really is, which is it's good yarns, good stories.
Robert and David, for folks who might be listening and wondering about really who it's designed for, I know it's sort of it's for anybody who wants to kind of talk money, but we've had a couple questions online already about, you know, sort of the target audience for your event on Tuesday night. How would you describe it?
I don't think there's any specific target audience. I mean, we're talking about things like retirement. We're talking about things like owning a home and making that decision. We're talking about, you know, how young people decide to pay for college, whether, you know, how much debt. I mean, it's something that I think everyone can sort of, I mean, it's accessible to everyone. I think the only, if you want to come, you should have questions on your mind and sort of want to be in a room where it's all about a conversation. If you're looking to, you know, if you need, feel like you need a financial advisor who's going to sit down with you one-on-one and sort of go through the nuts and bolts of investments and so forth, that's not what's going to be there. It's really a conversation. And if people listen to, you know, Robert's stories on the air, some of our economic reporting on Morning Edition, you know, it's about life. It's about people. You hear voices. And that's kind of the environment that we're going to create. So if that's something that you're interested in, I think that, you know, it's a perfect spot to come to.
It'll be fun.
And it'll be fun.
is there a sense for people who come to these events who may feel intimidated, a sense of almost liberation that they can ask these questions and feel like, all right, I don't know a credit default swap from compound interest from, you know, debt ratios, et cetera. Is there a liberation to coming to these events to saying, it's okay that you don't know all these terms. There's a lot of people in your boat, and that sharing your own stories is sort of this communal thing that probably connects us in many ways.
Yeah, I mean, when you hear somebody say who's like, "Yeah, I'm a college professor and I know these things," and yeah, I didn't actually prepare to send my own kid to college or for retirement. I mean, listen, like we all feel guilt sometimes about maybe paying too many banking fees or not putting as much away in savings as we should, and there is something nice about talking to other people who are smart, intelligent, successful people who say, "Yeah, I kind of screwed up, but what can I do now?" And that's the tone that we want is to say like, okay, like we're all in these situations. And so you tell us our story. What are your priorities? What do you want out of life? And like, let's talk about ways to achieve that.
Robert, you got your fan call. Kelly writes to us to say, "I love David Green. Ask him about his book." Sorry, Kelly. We'll do a whole separate show with David on his book if he'll let us coming out.
Absolutely. Totally, thank you, Kelly.
It's totally unrelated. But David, you do have a book coming out, don't you?
I do have a book coming out. It is totally unrelated. It's a book about the Trans-Siberian Railroad, and I'm excited about it, and I would love to come talk about it for Kelly and anyone else who's interested.
Well, then we'll have you on the program. We'll see you back here soon. We will see both of you Tuesday night. David Green, NPR Morning Edition host, and Robert Smith, Planet Money correspondent. They're going to be here Tuesday night at 7 p.m. at the Hatch Hall at the Eastman School of Music at the University of Rochester. The event called NPR Presents Family Matters, Your Financial Lifetime, and WXXI is proud to partner. Head to WXXI.org to reserve your seats. Guys, we'll see you Tuesday. You're generous with your time, and we're thrilled to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Evan. See you next week.
All right, a short break here, and we're going to come back here and hear from the Lieutenant Governor candidate, Timothy Wu, who is running with Zephyr Teachout. His comments coming up next, but first I should probably tell you a little bit about what's coming up Friday on the Next Connections. Typically Friday is the first Friday of the month is Arts Friday, and we're going to kind of split it up. Tomorrow, the first hour, we're going to continue to explore the issues surrounding the death of a Rochester police officer. We'll continue that conversation about the first line of duty death in Rochester in 55 years. We'll do that tomorrow in the first hour. Then in a shortened version of Arts Friday, we'll preview the upcoming Fringe Festival with a conversation with the artists. That's all coming up Friday on Connections.
The two journalists beheaded by ISIS were dressed in orange, like the jumpsuits some detainees in Gitmo are required to wear. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with New York Times reporter Charlie Savage, who has reported extensively about Gitmo and was there in August. This week, he reported on how Gitmo is decaying and why it's been so difficult to close. Join us.
Tonight at 7.
All right, welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. If you're just joining us, we spent the first hour talking about the first police line-of-duty death in Rochester since 1959, an officer shot and killed last night in the city. This afternoon, we will have a number of things for you. First of all, Rochester Police Chief Simonelli expects to hold another news conference coming up this afternoon to tell us more about the suspect involved, the details of the case, and more about what we still don't know. Second of all, we have plenty of continuing coverage coming up on this afternoon with Alex Crichton. Alex will be anchoring that, and as he always does, and have all of the information that we have and that is breaking for you related to that. So that's coming up this afternoon. Coverage throughout the day, and you can jump on WXXINews.org right now. And read plenty of coverage, not only coverage of what happened, but statements from Police Chief Simonelli, Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren, and more. And right now, you can hear our first hour, if you missed it, in which we had a chance to talk to former Chiefs Jim Shepherd and Bob Duffy on this program, their thoughts on Rochester losing a police officer and the tragedy that happened last night. So all of that on WXXINews.org right now. We're going to have a conversation now with Lieutenant Governor candidate Timothy Wu. And I know a lot of our listeners have been waiting for this conversation because of the events last night in Rochester with the police officer and the way we had to shift some of our coverage today. This interview was recorded this morning, so it's not live. We don't have a chance to take your calls on it, but I think you're going to hear a lot of interesting things from Tim Wu. Now, Tim Wu is running with Zephyr Teachout, two law professors who are challenging Governor Andrew Cuomo and Lieutenant Governor candidate Kathy Hochul in Tuesday's primary. I've extended invitations to all candidates for governor and lieutenant governor candidates, including Rob Astorino and Sheriff Moss on the Republican side, Governor Cuomo, Kathy Hochul. We've had Zephyr Teachout on, and this is our conversation with Timothy Wu. I imagine the demands on your time have changed in the last week, 10 days, maybe the last month. Tell us about that.
You can say that again. The lieutenant governor race is not always one that attracts a lot of attention, but since the New York Times endorsement in particular, my time has become nothing but campaigning. Campaigning is it's almost like a hungry monster that wants to consume every single possible second of your time. And it's changed. I mean, it's great to have the attention. It's exciting, and I'm really excited to have a chance to get my views and the views of our campaign out there.
It's important to understand how you view the office of lieutenant governor, and it's sort of been kind of maligned in the past as kind of a non-significant office. If you win on Tuesday, there are two very different possible scenarios, so let's start with this. If you and Zephyr Teachout win on Tuesday and you win in November, what do you view your role as lieutenant governor of New York State?
Well, believe it or not, I see it as the same whether Zephyr or Andrew Cuomo win on Tuesday. I think the lieutenant governor position is one of wasted potential. It's had some very talented people occupying the office, but by and large, I think the potential has been wasted. Traditionally, historically, it was an important office when it took a month to get somewhere, and so the governor would be out of commission for extremely long periods of time and need the lieutenant governor to take over. But in the current age, it's sort of lost its utility, given that we have airplanes. And so I plan to reinvent the office as a public advocacy position, where I would, regardless of whether it's Zephyr or Andrew Cuomo who wins, where I would take issues that I think are not getting enough attention and crusade on those particular issues, or weigh in on with an independent voice on issues of the day.
I imagine if Zephyr Teachout is the governor, you would have a little bit more, I don't want to say control over the message. I mean, you can say what you want, but it seems to me that if Andrew Cuomo is the governor and you are the lieutenant governor, you're more of kind of an ombudsman. Is that sort of fair?
No, I actually don't think of it that way. If I have said clearly that if Andrew Cuomo wins, I don't plan to take orders from him. you know, obviously we would work together, but I don't see myself as beholden I don't see him as working for him, and I've made that clear from the get-go. The lieutenant governor is also the senator, is also the president of the state senate, and I think has an independent legislative role. And, you know, I think it could be a position of mutual respect, whoever the governor is. But, no, I do not see it as an ombudsman role. I see it as the model for it is New York City's public advocate, who is someone who simply has an independent voice in the operation of government.
So give us a sense for, if you were the lieutenant governor right now, what would you be doing and saying about, for example, the Moreland Commission and what's transpired there?
Oh, that's a great example. So the Anti-Corruption Moreland Commission itself got corrupted, which seems like a bad joke unless you realize it's real. One of the things that I think should be happening is there should, after Governor Chris Christie was implicated, or staff was implicated in the Bridgegate scandal, there were immediately inquiries held. There is, as it stands, no inquiry ongoing into whether or not state law was violated in the both either the shutdown or the manipulation of the Moreland Commission. And I think it's important to have an inquiry and into whether state law was violated or not, and get to the bottom of what really happened. As it stands, the only entities doing that are, to some extent, the press, who lack a subpoena power. And, of course, we have a federal prosecutor who's taking that role on. But I think this is an example of where Lieutenant Governor could try to get an inquiry going.
Are you not confident in Preet Bharara and the work he's doing?
No, I'm not confident. But state law and federal law are different. And I think Preet Bharara doesn't have the jurisdiction to enforce state law. And at some level, the state also should be taking care of its own ethics problems. I think it sets a strange precedent when and not a good precedent, where when there's internal ethics problems, we rely on entirely on federal oversight to deal with them. The state should be a functioning entity that can take care of its own problems.
Whoever is the governor, if you're the lieutenant governor, would you push for more transparency? And I ask that because, you know, you brought up Chris Christie, and I'm not implying that you ought to have any love for Chris Christie, but at least after the Bridgegate allegations came out, he came out and did a news conference and spent more than 2 hours, and there were no PR flacks telling the media, one more question, wrap it up. Chris Christie said, whatever you want, at least I will stand here and talk about. Governor Cuomo, right, in contrast, spent days not talking and then gave the media in Albany and New York City essentially no heads up and showed up in the far western part of the state for a short news conference. And so, again, I'm not saying you ought to love Chris Christie, but at least that model is answer the questions. Would you push for more transparency in government?
I mean, absolutely, especially in a situation like this. I mean, I think it's an instructive comparison to look at what happened after Bridgegate and the Moreland Commission scandals were revealed, respectively. There were, and by my count, at least five different inquiries into Bridgegate. And as you said, Chris Christie did face the press, people have criticized him, but he did at least commission an inquiry into what happened. There were people fired. There has been a deafening silence in the aftermath. There is, the legal statement issued by the Cuomo team, which is incredibly defensive and, in fact, I think bad lawyering, but hasn't been challenged. Even the Republicans in the legislature, who would you think are naturally positioned to be critical of the governor, have done nothing. There's been some assemblymen who've criticized, but no inquiries. And so, yeah, I mean, it's not only transparency; it's actually an issue of accountability. Transparency is part of accountability, but basic accountability. And we have a massive problem with accountability in New York State, and it's amazing. We need to look to New Jersey for answers here, for comparison. But that's where it stands at this point. And I think we just have too much power concentrated in the governor's office right now. And again, we end up relying on federal prosecutors. And this is the problem with all of Albany. We've had 18 indictments over the last, 10 indictments over the last 18 months. And so we have a system where it only really gets oversight when things get so out of control that you have criminal charges brought against people as our main check on power. And I think we can, have some intermediate steps before that and discourage corruption before it reaches the point where we have the federal criminal apparatus putting people in prison.
You're running against Kathy Hochul on Tuesday, and when she served in Congress, for example, in a rather conservative congressional district, she highlighted her positions occasionally that were little more conservative, but in many other ways, she's been a consistent Democrat on a lot of issues. Her supporters say you're taking a few issues out of a large pile to make her look more conservative than she is. What would you say to that?
No, I think that's misrepresenting her record. I've gone carefully through her record, and the fact is that she crossed the floor more than 40 times to vote with House Republicans. There's a long record of, and it's not just on trivial issues or superficial things or one or two. It's on things that I think are core to what it means to be a Democrat. I'll give a few examples. You know, voting to drill the Arctic Wildlife Refuge is not a traditional Democratic position. The Clean Air Act, which frankly was passed by a bipartisan Congress in the early 70s, she has voted repeatedly to weaken or gut the Clean Air Act. These are not kind of optional positions. These are positions that ask the question, are you a Democrat or not? She also voted multiple times to repeal parts of the Affordable Care Act. And I guess I should point out, she has her defenses, but in almost when you look carefully at the record, there are only a tiny number of Democrats who joined her on these votes. You know, and some of them, she was one of only five or six Democrats, or 130 Democrats who somehow were able not to join her on these Republican initiatives. You know, weird things, too, like she voted to investigate Acorn, joined King on a program to sort of try to investigate people who supported Acorn, which is another Republican witch hunt. So, you know, there's just too many of them to claim now that she's a progressive Democrat. It doesn't add up.
My guest is Timothy Wu. He's running for lieutenant governor in the Democratic primary on Tuesday against Kathy Hochul. His running mate is Zephyr Teachout. She's running against the governor. I should let our listeners know that Kathy Hochul has a standing invitation to appear on this program, and some of her representatives have indicated to me that she may choose to do that over the next couple days before the election, and we hope that she will. Now, you took, for example, the Affordable Care Act, Tim, and let's a quick look at that indicates that even some Democrats have concerns with certain provisions in it. I've talked to many doctors who wanted reform but view some parts of the Affordable Care Act as inefficient. And now you've got Vermont, for example, moving in 2017 towards single payer. Could you ever foresee New York State government saying, even if the Affordable Care Act were well intended, we'd rather move toward, say, single payer?
You know, let me answer that in two ways. First of all, I think the states are clearly where the action is on a lot of issues that matter to Americans today, and healthcare is definitely one of them. I mean, there's all kinds of areas where we have this gridlock in Washington, which has stopped things which are supported by clear majorities of the country from going forward. I think we could move to single payer. I also think that if New York State wanted to, we could create our own version of the public option, which I think was the crucial missing element from the Affordable Care Act. So when the federal government does not act, the states need to. Another area where I think this is incredible is true and important is in immigration reform. The federal government is stuck on immigration, even though it's for states like New York, it seems obvious that if we make bets on immigration, that we will become more prosperous and a more We've always made bets on immigration, and we should retain those policies. So I think this is an area where the states are actually doing the interesting work, and I would hope to continue that tradition, or that new tradition as lieutenant governor.
Your comments on a different radio show did upset some members of the labor community, including the Working Families Party, and so we want to clarify some of these. First of all, scaffold law has been rather controversial. Would you keep it, scrap it, or reform it?
I would keep it. That was very early in the campaign, and I was hit with a series of surprise questions. And I actually didn't say anything. I just said, "Oh, I don't really know." But my words were twisted by the Working Family Parties, which of course has endorsed Cuomo and Hochul. I just to make this 100% clear, I favor the scaffold law, and I also favor the collective bargaining process protections in the Triborough Amendment. So those were areas where my comments were misinterpreted, and I can just make my stance on that very clear.
Okay, so scaffold, Wicks, Triborough, keep them, don't change them.
Keep them, don't change them. I mean, in particular, I'll say with Triborough Amendment, the collective bargaining process is already one where the labor is at a disadvantage and has gotten over the years more at a disadvantage. And I think Triborough Amendment is particularly important. It's a clever mechanism. It sets the default as what was bargained at last time, even when the agreement elapses. So I think that's an important default rule that helps labor at a time when public sector is under attack, and when where I think we should be investing in a stronger public sector, and instead the public sector is being weakened. The Triborough Amendment is particularly important.
These comments now, this clarification, and I take the point that sometimes comments can feel taken out of context, but the business community that we've heard from up here was actually somewhat excited by your comments, and today hearing your clarification, they may be disappointed to hear it. So you and
Let me say one thing. I haven't said that much about scaffolding. I support it as it is. I would say that if it could be, that the in my view, the ideal solution is some version of a workers' compensation system. But I would not favor abolishing scaffolding law. I would favor some study of whether we could move to a workers' compensation system. Because workers' compensation systems are a lot, the transaction costs are a lot lower for these things, and the randomness is much different. So that's my position on scaffold law.
Okay. And the business community has heard you and Zephyr Teachout say during this campaign that you are on the side of small business, that small business is where the engine is, that too many laws favor a kind of tilt the scales toward big business, et cetera. So even if they're disappointed to hear you talk about these different provisions, scaffold, WICs, Triborough, where can you show them that your candidacy is on the side of small business?
Well, it's to me, the most important thing with small business is enforcement policy. I think our enforcement policy right now is backwards. One of the things I think we need to catalog is the degree to which the state is relying on finding small business as a source of revenue. And to have a full picture of the degree to which law enforcement is working against small business as opposed to large business. So I agree actually with some of the ideas that, first of all, there just are too many regulations, period. When you study the gross number of them, they're absurd. There's a Senate report that I agree that just the number could be reformed. But more important than the number, I mean, if a law is on the book but it's not enforced, it doesn't matter that much. It really matters at the enforcement level. And I have the problem is that because larger businesses have better lawyers and also are able to and also are donors, that they tend to be overlooked. Andrew Cuomo, when he was Attorney General, did almost no law enforcement against Wall Street in the midst of the financial crisis. I mean, nobody. No, he was the Attorney General. One sector of the economy threw the entire country into a serious recession. There was obviously laws broken. No one doubts that there was fraud committed at multiple levels. There's been federal investigations. Andrew Cuomo did nothing, and it's endemic of a state enforcement policy, which is all about letting large business off and all about overly targeting small business and new businesses. I'll give another example. You know, Airbnb getting started in the city of New York was immediately targeted, and individuals were fined. You know, there's examples of individuals being fined $75,000 for having someone stay in their spare room, which strikes me as wildly disproportionate to what should be going on. And again, because they're an easy target. And I'm concerned because of protection of incumbent businesses like hotels. So our enforcement priorities, in my mind, in New York State are exactly backwards. And that's one area where we can help small business.
We're talking to Tim Wu for a few more minutes. He's running for lieutenant governor in Tuesday's primary against Kathy Hochul. Tim, Zephyr Teachout has said repeatedly on this program that labor is really going to be more benefited by your administration, not the Cuomo administration. But last Friday, four different labor leaders on this program essentially said that labor is kind of sitting out this primary because they fear repercussions if they back the governor's opponent. What do you make of that?
You know, once again, it's the famous Cuomo fear factor. And the state has become a place, as we were talking about with the Moreland Commission, where people are afraid to speak their minds for fear of retribution. And I can't believe, you know, it's sort of astonishing. Most of my experience is in the federal government, and it's been astonished in this process by how many people say to me, I would love to support you, but I am afraid. And I'm like, what kind of state are we living in? Or people say, I can't be in this picture because I don't want it to be seen and there to be retribution. And is this the United States of America where people are afraid to speak their minds for fear of retribution by the government? It doesn't sound, I mean, we had a revolution for a reason. You know, we have a First Amendment for a reason, but there's a widespread fear. And I find it distressing. And I agree with you that I think one of the reasons, look, Cuomo has been no friend to labor, but the reasons, obviously, they're afraid is they're afraid of retribution if they speak their minds. Not all unions. There have been unions who've stood up with us and spoken against the Cuomo administration, the PEF, Public Employees Federation, being one. One of the first was the Yonkers Firefighters Department. But we need to get out. A culture of fear is no way to run a state.
Have you heard from elected leaders, state representatives, who've said to you, I can't be in this picture, or I can't endorse you even though I want to?
Yes, including very highly placed members of the, not of the administration, but highly people in higher offices in the state have privately expressed support, but have said they are unable to, will not be able to, and of course I won't mention who they are because that would be a betrayal, but yes.
Now, you're known as the guy who coined the term net neutrality. We've covered it on this program before, but I'm not sure the average person has a good grasp of it. You continue to oppose the big merger between Time Warner and Comcast. Explain to our listeners why that is.
Okay, so the merger, the Comcast takeover of the Time Warner system would be of our cable system in New York would be clearly antithetical to the public interest. The state government has a duty, unless it can certify the merger is in the public interest, to block it. Our research reveals that Comcast, so Time Warner's average bill, already too high, is $105 a month. Comcast's average bill is $156 a month. And we predict that if Comcast is able to raise prices to the level it gets across the country in New York, it'll cost consumers an extra $1.6 billion per year. And I think that makes it obvious that the merger should be stopped. I think cable prices are high enough as they are, and we don't need the increases that would result clearly from a Comcast takeover. And Comcast has been open. When asked about this, will you raise prices, they just say, yes, we will. And they expect to get away with it. And it's actually shocking that the regulatory officials can sit there, have a company say, we want to buy this company because we want to raise prices for consumers, and say, okay, we don't have a problem with that. So I think it very clearly should be stopped. The state has the power to stop it within the borders of New York State, and I have been pressuring them to do that.
We've seen other political leaders, though, including Assembly Majority Leader Joe Morelli, a Democrat, supporting the merger, saying that these companies have a record of expanding Internet access for diverse populations, including impoverished communities. Is he wrong?
They have a record of violating their merger conditions and being fined for doing so. The last time they merged with a company, Comcast, I'm talking about now, they said they were going to make available a so-called discount $40 a year program, but then they failed to advertise it anywhere. So if you don't know something exists, you can't access it. The problem is that Comcast thinks they can get this merger through by paying off all the necessary people, well, not only in donations but in merger conditions, where they're like, okay, we will do this or do that or do this. But they have to compare these tiny trade-offs against the $1.6 billion per year. One-time trade-offs or putting people on the board or handing out little goodies. This is where government gets corrupted, is when it's willing to accept payoffs as opposed to do what's in the public interest. And as Lieutenant Governor, I would speak up for situations where we need to stand for the public and against a payoff system of running the state.
Tim, let me wrap our conversation by asking you sort of an odd question this late in the campaign. But, you know, the old notion is that voters don't really engage in the summer doldrums in July and August, and that doesn't give you a whole lot of time to reach people who didn't know you before. So a brief background on your own work and professional history and why you ended up wanting to be lieutenant governor.
Oh, thanks so much. I appreciate that opportunity. I am a law professor at Columbia Law School. I was a clerk for Justice Stephen Breyer on the United States Supreme Court. I've worked for the federal government in the Federal Trade Commission. I've written various books, including The Master Switch, and I came up with the phrase net neutrality earlier in my career. I've worked on the board of various media reform organizations, including I was the chairman of the board of Free Press. So I've been working for a long time for the public's interest against concentrated private power, and I have a track record and a series of accomplishments that I hope that voters can get to know. And I will do a good job as Lieutenant Governor and breathe some fresh life into Albany.
That's Lieutenant Governor candidate Tim Wu joining us today. He's running with Zephyr Teachout, though, again, on Tuesday's primary. It is possible that one candidate could win on the governor's side, but their running mate would lose on the lieutenant governor's side. You know, for example, it is possible that Andrew Cuomo could win the primary on Tuesday, but that Kathy Hochul could lose to Tim Wu. And what would happen? Well, then Cuomo and Wu would be on the ticket together in November against Rob Astorino and Sheriff Moss. That would be a fascinating dynamic. And with the New York Times endorsement last week, Tim Wu thinks he has a shot at it. So we appreciate his time. We've invited Kathy Hochul on this program. We've invited Andrew Cuomo many times. We have invited Rob Astorino and Sheriff Moss. And, of course, Rob Astorino has been on the program twice, but we'd like him to come back for a full hour if he can. So our goal is to bring all of the candidates to you and give you a chance to have some access to them. That's Tim Wu, running for lieutenant governor. A couple of quick notes before we wrap up the program today. By now it's no secret, and you probably have heard the news, that Rochester is mourning the loss of a police officer. Last night, 32-year-old Officer Daryl Pearson was shot and killed just before 10 p.m. in a shootout with a suspect who has a number of violations and incarcerations in his past. We're going to be learning more about the 38-year-old suspect later this afternoon. But Daryl Pearson was 32 and married with two children, a child who just started kindergarten yesterday and a three-month-old. And he leaves them behind. Tragic loss for their family and our entire community. The first Rochester police officer killed in the line of duty in 55 years. So we're going to be hearing more from the police department this afternoon. All Things Considered host Alex Crichton will be covering that for you, and you will certainly be up to speed on all of those developments. Then tomorrow on this program at noon, we continue the community conversation about the death of a Rochester police officer, and we'll welcome more of your interaction and phone calls, joining us online as well. And we'll make sure we keep the conversation moving tomorrow at noon. Thanks for all of your participation in the conversations today. As always, thanks to our engineer, Dave Campo, and all of my colleagues here at WXXI News. I'm Evan Dawson, and this is Connections on member-supported public radio.